Well, it's so long since Peter's first epistle was the theme of our Sunday evening sermons that some of you weren't here then, and those of you who were here have probably forgotten all about it. But Peter's first epistle was the theme of our Sunday evening sermons for a considerable period of time. We reached as far as chapter 3, verse 17. We then took a break from it, a break which lasted, I'm sure, much longer than any preacher's manual would ever recommend. But better late than never, we're going to resume this evening in this particular New Testament book. I said previously that this book was written to a mainly Jewish constituency. That's hard perhaps to prove, but it seems a reasonable thesis that these people to whom Peter wrote were Jewish converts to Jesus Christ, who had lived in Rome and had there developed a relationship with the Apostle Peter, but who had subsequently been expelled from Rome and forced, therefore, to begin a new life in Asia Minor, modern-day Turkey. That's what I suggested to you way back when we first started in 1 Peter, and that remains my basic understanding as to the background of this book. As I say, it could be wrong, but it seems a perfectly reasonable thesis that these were Jewish converts expelled from Rome, immigrants now in Asia Minor. And Peter then is writing to these people in a very difficult situation. They've had to up sticks, they've had to relocate altogether. And he's writing to encourage them, and he's writing to instruct them. And we're then going to resume our studies this evening, but we're going to break ourselves in gently. We're only going to focus on one verse. In fact, it's not even an entire verse. We're just going to look this evening at the first half of 1 Peter 3, verse 18. It's well known, "For Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God." For Christ died for sins once for all, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. And so as we spend a few minutes thinking about these words this evening, there are three things that I would like us to do. I would like us to look behind the text, I would like us to look into the text, and I would like us to look beyond the text. So first of all then this evening, let's look behind the text. What do I mean by that? Well, it seems to me that there are several biblical themes kind of floating around in the background as Peter writes this verse. And if we just spend a couple of minutes flagging those truths up, then I think it will lend more clarity and more bite to what the text says. So, first of all then, biblical truth number one. Human beings are without God. Human beings are without God. I'm quoting there, of course, from the Apostle Paul in that passage we read earlier on, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 12. This is how he describes the Ephesians' natural condition, without hope and without God. This past week, as many of you know, I was in Leicester at a minister's conference. On the whole, the conference was good, but it was rather overshadowed by a sad episode on the opening evening. The speaker that night was a man whose ministry has been eminently blessed by God over several decades. Many, many people, including I know some of you here tonight, have benefited from him. He is arguably one of the greatest living preachers in the English-speaking world. But 18 months ago, he was taken seriously ill with encephalitis, acute inflammation of the brain. And this was the first time he had spoken at a conference since then. And it all went horribly wrong. He started to repeat himself. He got ever so muddled. He went round and round in circles. He couldn't get through the sermon. And it was a profoundly distressing experience to sit there watching this prince among preachers reduced to floundering in that kind of way, in such a public context. But of course, if you were at the conference and you'd never heard of that particular preacher, or you'd never heard him preach before, then you wouldn't really appreciate, would you, how sad and distressing it was. You would understand that something had gone wrong, and you'd feel an element of concern and sympathy for this poor man in the pulpit, but it was the knowledge of what he used to be. It was the knowledge of how powerful and how rich and how penetrating his preaching used to be that made Monday evening so appalling. And in a similar way, Paul's little phrase there in Ephesians 2 verse 12, without God, in and of itself, if you just read it as an abstract phrase, human beings are without God, it might seem fairly unremarkable. You really need to read the first few pages of the book of Genesis to properly understand what Paul is saying there in Ephesians 2:12. It's the knowledge of what man used to be when first created. It's the knowledge of just how thoroughly God-oriented his existence was there in the Garden of Eden, where God would walk and would interact with him so intimately in face-to-face communion. It's the knowledge of that. It's the knowledge of man's original creation status that makes Ephesians 2 verse 12, man is without God, so dreadful and so appalling. In fact, we could go further still. For man to be without God is such a radical departure from what he used to be at creation. It's such a gross distortion of his former existence, communing with God in the Garden of Eden. It's so entirely at odds with the whole purpose of his creation that it is effectively a state of death. That's there too in that passage in Ephesians, isn't it? Paul can describe the Ephesians' natural condition as being without God, chapter 2, verse 14. But equally, he can describe the Ephesians' natural condition as being dead, chapter 2, verse 1. We've heard the arguments, haven't we, of those critically ill people who want the right to end their lives in an act of assisted suicide. Well, here I am and I can't move a muscle of my body. I can't talk to my friends and family. I can't eat food. I can't work or play. I can't rest or relax or read or do anything. I'm effectively dead. I'm living but not really alive. I'm basically dead, and so please let me die. Now, I don't want to get into the ethics of that this evening, but just to use it as an illustration that Paul is saying here, that for human beings created for God, created to be in communion and fellowship with God, human beings wired up fundamentally and unalterably to glorify God and enjoy him forever, for those human beings to be without God, that is effectively to be dead. It's no life that they have. They're living but not alive. They are effectively dead. So that's the first basic Bible truth in the background of this text. Human beings are without God. Truth number two, sin is the reason for this. Sin is the reason for this. Why is it that human beings then are without God? Human beings created for communion with him there in the beginning. How is it that now human beings are without God, locked into this state of living death? How has this come about? Well, again, the answer's there in the Ephesians 2 passage. Because there in verse 1, Paul explicitly connects this state of death with what? With trespasses and sins, doesn't he? Dead in trespasses and sins. In other words, it isn't that God, at a certain point, got bored with the human race and just walked away, transferring his attention to squirrels, or to angels, or to another race of creatures altogether in some parallel universe or something. No, God never got bored with the human race. The human race, human beings, sinned against God. They disobeyed him. They defied him. They rebelled against him. And so God, understandably and reasonably, terminated the happy and harmonious relationship that had previously existed. That's why there's this terrible plunge from Genesis, from where what we have in Genesis 1 and 2 to what we have in Ephesians 2 verse 12. This terrible plunge from man knowing God and loving God and communing with God to man lacking God. It's a penal thing. It's punishment. God withdrawing himself from the human race on account of their sin. Sin is the reason for this withdrawal, this living death that man now finds himself in. And then truth number three. Human beings experience this withdrawal or death in a staggered way. Human beings experience this withdrawal or death in a staggered way. So yes, they are dead without God. Now, in this world, that's the very language Paul uses, isn't it, there in Ephesians 2:12? Without hope and without God in the world. Now, in the present, he's talking about. But that divine withdrawal, that absence of God, is never in this life absolute, is it? It's never total. You remember how Paul, in Acts 17, addressing those pagans in Athens, uses a very striking phrase, Acts 17, verse 27. He says to them, he, that is God, is not far from each one of us. God is not far from each one of us. He's talking to out and out pagans there in Athens. He's not far away, he's saying. Yes, that intimacy of communion and fellowship that was there in Eden, that's certainly gone. God has distanced himself. God has withdrawn from human beings. But he's still near. Near enough to bestow daily blessings and gifts and benefits to every single human being who lives on planet Earth. This is why, isn't it? Many people around us don't seem dead. Paul's description in Ephesians 2:1 doesn't seem to ring true of many people around us. Some people perhaps do. But you see, some who just drift. Like that Samaritan woman in John 4, from relationship to relationship to relationship, looking for a satisfaction, a fulfillment, constantly eluding them. Or some who just, out of despair, basically vegetate in front of the TV screen for hours upon hours, day after day after day. You do see some people, and you can almost see what Paul means, written all over them, what Paul means in Ephesians 2:1, they're dead. They're without God, and they're just desperately looking for anything that will fill the void. But many don't look like that. Many seem purposeful in their lives. Many seem contented. Why is that? Well, the answer is because in this life, this state of death, which is true of all human beings naturally, it's tempered by the fact that God hasn't yet withdrawn himself absolutely. It's a bit like, you know, how in ancient culture, you see it in the Gospels, they used spices, didn't they? When somebody had died, we see it when Jesus died. And the women, and also Nicodemus and Joseph of Arimathea, they took spices, didn't they, to his tomb. The idea being that the spices would kind of delay the onset of corruption in the body. They would kind of temper the effects of death, so that death wouldn't have quite as severe an impact on that body that it otherwise would do without the spices. And it's a bit like that, isn't it? That yes, human beings, all human beings, naturally, in this world are dead, they're without God. But the onset, the encroachment of that death is tempered somewhat by the fact that God still hasn't withdrawn himself totally, and he still lavishes blessings and good things and gifts even on those who have no real relationship with him at all. But you see, that only lasts for a time. And then death, physical death, comes. And then human beings are propelled into another state, into another realm, where God withdraws himself absolutely. That's hell, isn't it? We could describe hell in many different ways. We could stack up the different images and pictures that the Bible uses. But as succinct a description as any is this: hell is God altogether withdrawing himself from human beings. There the withdrawal is absolute. There the death is complete. There the absence of God is total. There everyone, even those who in this life might seem, as I say, purposeful and contented, there everyone will give the fullest expression to their deadness. In fact, what we see in some people now, the vegetating in front of the TV for hours every day, whatever it might be, that's nothing compared to what people will be doing in hell, the expression they will give there to their deadness. That will seem wholesome and healthy compared to the form of deadness they will assume in hell, the lens they will be driven to, made to glorify and enjoy God, and yet God has altogether removed himself. And they will go to the most desperate, desperate lengths to fill that void. Made for God, and yet God absolutely and unreservedly gone. That's hell. And so I'm saying then, this is the third biblical truth, that yes, human beings are without God, but it's staggered. There's a sense in which they're without God in this life, but that's nothing compared to the sense in which they're without God in the next life, in hell. So those are three kind of background considerations lying behind the text. But then secondly this evening, let's look into the text itself. Let's look at what Peter actually says in verse 18 of chapter 3. And he begins then, Christ died for sins. Now the word for there, it's not the same word as the word for, as the second word for. So Christ died for sins once for all. The righteous for the unrighteous. There's three instances of the word for. But this first one is a different word. It really means more like concerning. Christ died concerning sins, or in relation to sins. There was a connection between his death and sins. That's what Peter is saying. And it's saying then that Christ experienced this death as a result of sin that we have just been talking about. This being without God, which we have described as death, biblically, I hope. Peter is saying that Christ experienced that. Christ, if you like, entered into the Ephesian condition. Christ entered into the Geordie condition. Christ entered into the universal human condition. Human beings, we're saying, are without God and so dead. And Christ, Peter is saying, also entered into that experience. But having said that, as you read on in the verse, it becomes very clear that his experience of this death is unique. And it's unique in three ways. First of all, it's instantaneous. Christ died for sins once for all. He doesn't mean they're once for all people, he means once for all time. So, whereas the ordinary human experience is this death staggered, we've been saying, for Christ it wasn't staggered. For Christ it was an instantaneous, all-in-one-act experience. So, for him it wasn't a lifelong being without God. followed by then a further intensification of that after death. No, for Christ, the whole package, the whole thing was experienced in one instant. What was that instant? Well, we know, don't we? It was Calvary's cross. It was at the cross that Christ experienced this death as a result of sin, this being without God. And there he experienced it then in its awful fullness. The hell form of it that we talked about a moment ago. The absolute withdrawal. The absolute state of being without God. That's what he experienced on the cross. That's why he cried out in such anguish at the ninth hour, my God, why have you forsaken me? He was forsaken. In the language of the older theologians, he was derelict. He was abandoned there at that ninth hour. And some of the other aspects of that Good Friday experience point in the same direction. The 3 hours of darkness has many significances, but surely one significance is this. It takes us back to the Sermon on the Mount. What is one of the most basic gifts of God's grace to all human beings? The sunshine, the sun that shines on the righteous and the unrighteous. Jesus was denied even the shining of the sun. What's the other basic thing that God gives, even to the righteous and the unrighteous? Rain. And Jesus cried out, I thirst. For him, God had completely withdrawn. It was hell in its most intense and undiluted and unmitigated form that Jesus was experiencing. There's nothing staggered about this death, this being without God for Jesus. It fell on him in one terrible stroke there on Golgotha's cross. It was instantaneous. But then, secondly, his experience of it was undeserved. It was undeserved. Because he continues, the righteous. That's what he calls Jesus. The righteous. And we've been presented here then with this huge irony. The one person in history who didn't deserve to be without God, who didn't deserve to be dead, was without God in the fullest sense and dead as he hanged there on Calvary. He's righteous, Peter says. Righteous, a righteousness in his conception that meant he didn't inherit from Adam the guilt of the Garden of Eden. Virgin, miraculous conception. And then a righteousness in all his subsequent 30-odd years. A complete righteousness. Isn't it amazing that when his enemies were desperately trying to get some charge to stick, to lay some charge against Jesus that would ensure he was executed, the only thing they could come up with was this: he claimed to be the Son of God. None of them could credibly come up with an accusation, well, he once lied to me. Or he once committed sexual impurity. The only thing they could come up with against Jesus was he claimed to be the Son of God. Imagine if it was you or me standing there. Boy, they could come up with plenty of accusations against us. But Jesus couldn't find a single one. Righteous. It was undeserved. This death on account of sins that he experienced. It was instantaneous, it was undeserved, but then thirdly and crucially, it was saving. His experience of death was saving. The righteous for the unrighteous. And this time then, it's the more straightforward word for that we have so often in Paul's writings. It's the for of substitution. On behalf of is a longer way you could render the word. The righteous on behalf of the unrighteous. Just as a football commentator will say, well, so-and-so has come on for so-and-so. straightforward substitution. That's what Peter is talking about here. In other words, Christ wasn't experiencing this death, this being without God on the cross, simply so that he could sympathize with the general human condition. So that in a million years' time, he could kind of pop down into hell and say, look guys, I know how you're feeling down here because I once experienced it myself at Calvary. Like Prince William, you remember, kind of spending a night with the homeless on the streets of London. Didn't really do anything, didn't give any of them a bed or a home. But it was, I suppose, a gesture whereby you can always say, now, well, I know what these guys are going through. I know what they feel like. It wasn't like that with Jesus going to the cross. It wasn't going there as some sympathetic gesture. No, he was going there in the place of sinners. He was going there to rescue, to relieve, to liberate. He was going there so that Paul could write in Ephesians chapter 2 to those members of the Ephesian church, not you are without hope and without God, but you were without hope and without God. But that has now been reversed. Now you have God. Now you're no longer dead in trespasses and sins. That state is over. It's finished because he experienced it in your place at the cross of Calvary. So that, as Peter gets to this wonderful climax, so that you might be brought to God, to bring you to God. The complete reversal. Naturally, we're without God. Naturally, he's withdrawn himself. He's distant from us. Partially in this life, totally in the life to come. Now Christ has done something to reverse that. Now those who are trusting in him are brought to God. And again, I think like its converse, this is staggered too. So that those who are redeemed by Christ, they're brought to God partially in this life. We have God now, don't we, if we're believers tonight? We're talking about this morning, weren't we, in relation to Psalm 23, verse 5. Already we're in God's house. We've been brought into his fellowship. Already now he lays a table for us. Every day we wake up, he lays a table for us and pours wine into our cup and allows us to enjoy his presence and his fellowship and his communion. I am like an olive tree flourishing in the house of God now, David can write. But that doesn't compare to the way in which we shall be brought to God, does it? When finally our days in this world are ended and we are ushered into his nearest and most intimate presence. It's why Peter can say in chapter 1 and verse 18, that you have been redeemed from the empty way of life handed down to you from your forefathers. Your life's no longer empty now because you have God. You're no longer trying to fill it with God's substitutes. Your life is genuinely meaningful now because you have communion with God. You have him now. That's why Peter can also repeatedly, from the very introductory paragraph and at several points throughout, refer to these people as strangers and exiles. Because they haven't yet got God in the fullest sense. They're going to get God more fully when finally they leave the land of exile, this world, and enter into his presence. So, Jesus entered into this, the human condition, in its fullest form, death, the absence of God. In his case, it was instantaneous. In his case, it was undeserved. And wonderfully, in his case, it was saving. It was substitutionary. He was without God that we might be brought to God. So we've looked behind the text, we've looked into the text. But then thirdly and finally, let's look very briefly beyond the text. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean, what does this mean for us tonight in Newcastle in 2012? What applications are there for us? If we're believers tonight, what applications are there for us? Well, three. First of all, think rightly about salvation. Think rightly about salvation. What is the great end, the great goal of salvation? Well, you say it's surely justification, be made right with God, having all our sins forgiven, being cleansed, being absolved from all guilt. And indeed, that is a wonderful, wonderful privilege of our salvation, isn't it? But that's not the end of our salvation. That's a means to an end. God didn't send his Son for our forgiveness. End a sentence. He did send his Son for our forgiveness. But he sent his Son for something greater than that. He sent his Son to bring us to God. Our forgiveness, our cleansing, our justification is a means to a greater end. It comes out in Paul's epistle to the Romans. You know that great epistle in which Paul lays out so fully the riches of our salvation, those early chapters particularly. And he goes into great detail, doesn't he, about our lost condition, our deadness, our being without God in those early chapters. And then he comes to what God has done through Christ at the cross, the justification that Christ has wrought at the end of chapter 3. But you know, great though that passage is at the end of chapter 3, Paul hasn't reached his climax yet. You go through chapter 4 where he explores justification from an Old Testament perspective through the lens of Abraham. Still, he hasn't reached his climax. You go to chapter 5 and he starts talking about how God demonstrated his love for us while we're still sinners, Christ died for us. He still hasn't reached his climax. Where's his climax? Well, it's a verse that probably we're barely even aware of. It's verse 11, surely, chapter 5, where he writes this: "Not only is this so, but we also rejoice," or boast is another translation, "in God." That's why we're saved. Not to be justified, but beyond that, to boast in God, to rejoice in God, to know God, to enjoy God, to relish God, to savor God, to treasure God, to bask in the riches and depths and beauties and excellencies of God. That's why we're saved. That's the great goal of our salvation. Let's make sure we think rightly about it, that we don't just settle for forgiveness, great though that is, but go beyond that to enjoying and knowing God. We've been brought to God. Secondly, think rightly about life. Think rightly about life. Because even as those then who have been objectively brought to God through Christ's work, we can sometimes surely be lax and neglectful, can't we, in actually enjoying what Christ has brought us to, pursuing God and seeking God and contemplating God and becoming intimate with God. There's an objective sense in which we have been brought to God, but there's a subjective sense in which that needs to be cultivated and worked out in our experience, isn't there? In other words, as Christian people, we can just go through our days barely thinking of God, barely giving any attention to the means of grace, as we often call them, the Bible and prayer and fellowship with other believers, the great events of the Lord's Day. And yes, then objectively we've been brought to God, but it doesn't really show in our life, in our daily routines, in the shape, the contours of our experience. And we need to understand then that we've been brought to God. And what's life about? It's about getting to know him, pursuing him. We're not here to pursue with all our hearts the football results on the back of the newspaper. We're not here to pursue with all our hearts the plot line of the soap opera on television. We're here to pursue with all our hearts the living God. We've been brought to God. Let's wake up every morning thinking in those terms. What's today about? I'm not saying that it's about going into some monastery and kind of piously meditating. No, we're to live full lives, getting on with things. But why? For His glory. So that we'll please Him. And it's all for Him. Think rightly about life. He is the goal. He's what it's all about. We've been brought to God. But then thirdly, think rightly about the future. If I'm right then in saying that it's staggered, this being brought to God. We've been brought to God now. We know Him now. And that's great. We engage with the living God. But there's more to come. And let's look forward to that. And yes, let's look forward, as I was saying this morning, to all aspects of our glorious future. Let's look forward to everything that Christ's return will mean. Let's look forward to the resurrection of the body. Let's look forward to the rejuvenation of the physical universe. Let's look forward to reunion with Christians that death parted us cruelly from. Let's look forward to everything that lies ahead. But most of all, let's look forward to God. Let's look forward to being where He is. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they will see God. Isn't that just a mind-boggling verse? What does it mean to see God? Well, we don't know yet, but that will be our experience if we're in Christ. And that will be the chief jewel then of our future in glory. Yes, there'll be many jewels, but the one that will sparkle the brightest will be that deepening of our relationship with God beyond anything we can even imagine now. Of course, we'll never exhaustively know Him. He's infinite. All His attributes are infinite. We could never possibly exhaustively know His wisdom or His grace or His love or anything about Him, but it will be an endless journey getting to know Him better and better and better, seeing Him ever more clearly, engaging with Him ever more deeply, enfolded in His depths ever more profoundly. That's our future. May we look forward to it with relish. Amen.